Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On a Friday, here is what we've got. We've got gambling, we've got the bond market, we've got social networks, and of course, we've got our weekly wrap. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 26th of September. Friday, as I said, is once again upon us, which means there is a whole week's worth of stuff to talk about. And really, it's been a pretty busy 5 days. So here to help us figure out what happened are Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
All right. So let's start very quickly. First of all, Lynette, with the headline economic number of today, gross domestic product revised upward 4.2% to 4.6%. Give me your gut check.
All in all, this is great news. Everybody likes revision up. Everybody yes. likes a solid GDP number. It came in just in line with expectations. What we want to see now is consistency. We want that number to be good all the time. Instead, it kind of keeps waffling.
Well, Cardiff, about that, we're coming off a quarter of negative, I can't even remember, 1%, 2% growth. How much longer can we do the, you know, two steps forward, one step back thing?
Yeah, and I mean, some of this was a bounce back. Something to be worried yeah. about is that since the summer started, the pace of jobs growth has slowed a little bit. Inflation is moderated. So I'm actually feeling pretty relieved from where I was earlier in the year when we all worried that maybe what the downturn in the first quarter wasn't just a weather-related blip. It looks like it really was. Mm-hmm. That said, a lot depends on policy going forward. So I'm optimistic, cautiously, and it's no time to get complacent.
And policy going forward, of course, means Congress, and that, you know, that's just up in the air anyway. All right. Let us go a little inside baseball here, and I need you guys to drag us back out. Big news in the bond market today. Bill Gross, who runs the biggest bond fund in the world at a company called Pacific Investment Management Company, PIMCO, which he founded, resigned today out of nowhere. He's going to a much smaller firm. Lynette, make regular people care.
This is really just an incredible human story. This guy was at the top of Wall Street. He was a legend. He's 70 years old. He built this firm with his own hands. And then suddenly in January, people started to really worry when his co-CIO left the firm.
Mm-hmm. A guy by the name of Mohammed El Arian, also a very big deal.
Very well-respected economist. They were expected to be buddies for life. People started questioning what was going on at PIMCO. And then all of a sudden, these crazy reports started coming out. Bill Gross had this erratic behavior. He mm-hmm. thought he was the greatest thing known to man. And then in June, he appeared on stage to the tune of Rob Thomas and Carlos Santana's Smooth, wearing shades. And literally everyone thought he had lost his mind.
And now he up and quits. Cardiff, this guy could, I suppose, move the Treasury bond market all by his lonesome.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people are saying. I mean,
I detect cynicism.
It's not cynicism. I'm always skeptical of assigning causes to short-term swings okay. in the market. That includes the Treasury market. This is a story for, I think, people who are invested in PIMCO's funds. Mm-hmm. And this is a story for people who follow this stuff carefully. Otherwise, I'm not so sure. I want to spend too much time okay. making the regular person care. You know, I'm not so sure that he or she should.
All right. Fair enough. A story now that perhaps most of us should have paid more attention to back during the financial crisis. This American Life This Weekend, the radio program, which I'm sure a lot of people know, has been working with ProPublica on a story about recordings made inside the New York Fed during and after the financial crisis about the New York Fed's dealings with Goldman Sachs. It is a story of regulatory capture, Cardiff, and what regulators know and knew about what Goldman was doing and really how much they cared. It's kind of an amazing thing.
It's an incredible report. I think we actually have to take a step back to 2008 when the New York Fed commissioned an independent report investigating just what it failed to do, what it missed in the years leading up to the financial crisis. And one of the things the report found was that this is a big cultural story, a cultural problem inside the regulators. They were afraid to be confrontational. They were afraid to push back against the bankers. And what the report showed was that as recently as 2012, those problems had not yet been solved. There's a lot of reason to be doubtful that they've been solved in the time since.
Lynette, how shocked are you?
I'm not shocked at all.
Right.
And one thing that you'll notice in the first 10 minutes of the This American Life piece
right.
is that these are two cultures that when put together, Wall Street plus this regulatory capture at the Fed, are disastrous. Somebody at Goldman was at the Fed saying something about how when their clients are have a certain amount of money,
right,
the rules they can are fungible. They don't really right. – the rules don't apply to those clients anymore. So you have this I don't care whatever attitude from Goldman, like let's just do it, shoot first, ask questions later. And then at the Fed you have this appeasement and – people thought that it was great that the Fed was, you know, inside these Wall Street banks with,
right.
with
offices, physically inside, yeah,
physically inside the banks. But what research has shown is that that was actually a problem because, you know, the regulators wanted to be friends right. with the people at the banks and they didn't want to ruin their lives.
Regulatory capture. It is the phrase of the day. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider and Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next time. On Wall Street today, more triple-digit action by the buy. It was up this time. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You've heard the cynics' take on social networks, right? If you don't know what the product is in a social network, you're it. You and your data are how Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all the rest of them make money, mostly by selling us out to advertisers who then clutter up our feeds with ads. It's crazy-making, right? But it's also a business opportunity. A startup social network called Elo promises not to show us ads or mine our data, and it looks like consumers desperately want in. The site says it's been getting 45,000 sign-up requests every hour today, which is great for them, but how are they going to pay for it? Marketplace's Queenie Kim has more on that.
People are calling Elo the new Facebook, but it's sort of like a stripped-down blog where you can invite friends to join. And you don't have to use your real name. Unlike that other social network, it's in beta right now, and so you need an invite. When you request one, you have to agree with its manifesto, which boils down to this. You are not a product, and Elo won't sell your data. So, how are they going to pay for this? Paul Butnitz is a CEO and co-founder of Elo.
We're not trying to get everyone on Earth on Elo. It doesn't have to be worth $30 billion to be successful. It can just be a good business.
Butnitz says Elo won't be charging. Instead, it plans to sell special features, like tools to manage multiple accounts or emojis and stickers. Roseanne Winsek is a venture capitalist with Canaan Partners, and she says there's money to be made in hawking those goods. But Winsek says if Elo plans to accept the 45,000 invitations it claims to be getting every hour, the social network will need big money.
I think it would be hard to have investors and a ton of users and a ton of data on your users and then say that you're not going to use that data to make money in a really well-known, lucrative way.
Brett Koff is the CEO of Remind, a messaging app that's aimed at teachers and students. Like Elo, Remind doesn't sell advertising or user data. Koff says while it might be hard to get mass consumers to pay for privacy, there are businesses that'll shell out money for it.
Like in education or in healthcare, there are real privacy concerns.
And he says if there are real privacy concerns, people are willing to pay real money for it. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
For as much as you might think the house always wins, get a load of this. It's from Moody's. The ratings agency says that with the exception of Las Vegas itself, the gaming industry is deep in the red. Even so, some cash-strapped communities out there are still rolling the dice. Take, just for instance, the Northeast. It's got a slew of gaming projects on the books, including a mega casino out in New Jersey. Paul Fireman, the billionaire founder of Reebok, is behind that one. And so far, at least, the disaster that is Atlantic City doesn't seem to have fazed him. Sally Herships went out to the site of Fireman's Casino in Jersey City to see what she could find out.
Not very much. Despite a lot of talk about a multi-billion dollar plan and promises of tens of thousands of jobs, the details are hard to come by. Paul Fireman's company wouldn't get back to me. The mayor of Jersey City also didn't respond to requests for interviews. The only local politician who would talk was the pro-casino Democratic State Senator Ray Lesniak.
Wow is right. When I saw this, I said, wow.
The this that Lesniak is talking about is a shiny, full-color brochure promoting the benefits of the new casino. Can I touch the proposal? Can I like...
It's just something for us to consider as legislators when...
Lesniak says the project is expected to produce hundreds of millions of dollars in revenues a year. The plan includes a convention center, hotel, racetrack, and the world's largest Ferris wheel. The brochure shows a lot of pretty pictures and big numbers, but few details. But Lesniak says it will make New Jersey a global destination, pulling in tourists from New York.
Everyone who comes to Manhattan, this will be on their list. This will be a must-see.
So they're going to leave Manhattan, go to New Jersey so they can look at Manhattan?
That's just about it. They can gamble in our casinos in a superstructure. Yes, to look at it. It's an experience that does not exist anywhere in the world.
If the project goes ahead, it'll be built next to Liberty State Park. It's not on the radar of many community members yet, but Yvonne Balzer, a local activist and retired teacher, has concerns.
They're talking about maybe 100,000 people come to the city.
Balzer says she worries about everything from traffic capacity to unsavory types gambling might bring in. She says Jersey City isn't prepared to handle large crowds, and as a taxpayer, she doesn't want to foot any bills.
The developers don't put in the infrastructure at all. I mean water, I mean sewage, I mean roads. Those are the things that's done on the backs of taxpayers. It's not done on the backs of developers at all.
At this point, it's hard to know who'd foot the bill for what, or how the new project might affect Atlantic City's financially troubled casinos. Alex Boumajny is an analyst with Fitch Ratings.
If this proposal goes through, will having a new casino hurt Atlantic City even more?
It probably would.
Boumajny says even though there's talk of Atlantic City sharing in the revenues from the new project, the plans are uncertain. Besides, he says, the Northeast is already overly saturated with casinos.
So having another casino in northern New Jersey would be pretty detrimental to Atlantic City.
But this discussion remains theoretical. There's another problem we haven't even talked about. Outside of Atlantic City, gambling in New Jersey is illegal. And the next time a vote can take place on that issue isn't until next year. In Jersey City, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, television takes on the movies.
They invite these people into their homes because they're invested in those characters' lives.
Our series, Screen Wars, continues. But first, let's do the numbers. Good day, lousy week. The Dow Industrials picked up 1%, 167 points, 17,113. The NASDAQ also gained 1% today, 45 points. Ended things at 45.12. The S&P 500 advanced 0.8%, 16 points, 1,982 there for the week, and it was the worst of the last eight. The Dow off 1%, the NASDAQ dropped 1.5%, the S&P 500 down 1.4%. We told you about bond fund manager Bill Gross. He's going on to a company called Janus Capital, and how's this for a welcome? Janus shares jumped 43% on that news. Other stocks had some good revised GDP numbers to help them out. Morgan Stanley and Citigroup both ended the session more than 1% ahead. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.52%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the personal income and spending report for August. The National Association of Realtors issues its pending home sales index for August. And Monday is coffee day, right at the top of the week. How convenient. Latte, cappuccino, espresso, Americano, macchiato, decaf. Wait, no decaf. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Silicon Valley is dominated by men. In point of fact, it is dominated by white men. That is not news to anybody, I'm sure, least of all to people who work in Silicon Valley, specifically people who work at Google. Farhad Manju writes in the New York Times that the company knows it is behind the diversity times and is doing something about it. Farhad, it's good to have you back on the program.
Good to be here.
Google went looking for bias and found it, basically.
You know, Google's workforce is overwhelmingly male. About 70% of the people who work there are men. Mostly that's related to the fact that they hire a lot of engineers, software engineers, mm-hmm. and most of the people who work in software engineering are men. They basically are trying to uncover hidden biases, people not consciously being racist or sexist, but in ways that they don't know, you know, expressing attitudes that may be off-putting to women and minorities.
And they've been running workshops. I mean, they've kind of re-engineered HR to look for this and find it and then train people.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of companies have kind of diversity workshops, right. And often you kind of roll your eyes because they're not that useful. This one, I sat in on one, and it was extremely useful. It was interesting because it's based on a lot of research in psychology about how people express biases in ways they don't know. Google's basic message in these workshops is that everyone is a little bit racist, a little bit sexist, and the way to kind of make sure that you're not acting in that way is to be conscious of what you're saying, to be conscious that this is a problem and sort of not let your unconscious biases lead a meeting or lead the way.
Tell me about the conference rooms.
Yeah. So, you know, they build a lot of new buildings. In one of them recently, they named all the conference rooms after male scientists. In the past, they say someone might not have noticed that. Like, it might not have caught anybody's attention. But this time, people noticed, which was the first thing that happened.
Yeah.
And they complained, and facilities, you know, changed the names.
There is a... I guess you'd have to say there's a bottom line part of this as well, and you talk about this in the piece. Workforces that are more diverse are more creative and more productive, and that has to be at least in part why Google's doing this, besides it just being the right thing to do.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about Google is that it's working on problems that are, you know, no one has ever worked on before. It's doing things like inventing self-driving cars or other products of the future.
Right.
There's no sort of noted expertise on those kinds of problems. And so the way to solve those problems is to get an extremely diverse group of people looking at them. They feel like if they can get more women, if they can get more people from different parts of the world looking at these problems, they'll have a better chance to solve them than if they, you know, have a bunch of people who live and work in Silicon Valley and kind of look like the TV show Silicon Valley.
And given their size, one can assume that more people are going to be paying attention, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, this is the big issue in the Valley for the next few years, I think. You know, these companies represent in some way the future of the economy, and if they only employ a small number of people, that's not great.
Farhad Manju is a technology columnist for the New York Times. Farhad, thanks.
Thanks.
If you happen to be a customer of U.S. Bank, you might be in line for a refund. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has ordered the bank to make good with consumers who were charged for identity protection and credit monitoring services that they never got. This will come as a shock, I know, but fraud protection products are sometimes, yeah, frauds. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
I don't want to make you paranoid or anything, but these days, you have to be on the lookout for fraud, even in products that are supposed to prevent fraud. Prentice Cox teaches law at the University of Minnesota.
It's quite an irony that these identity theft products have been consistently found to be sold in a deceptive manner.
In the U.S. bank case, customers were charged for credit monitoring by a company the bank hired called Affinion. Now, you need written permission to monitor a person's credit report. Deb Morris is Deputy Enforcement Director at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. She says U.S. banks started charging consumers before they signed permission forms the bank sent out. Their credit was never monitored. But Morris says they were charged anyway.
So the Bureau determined that this conduct was an unfair practice and ordered U.S. Bank to repay consumers approximately $48 million.
Neither U.S. Bank nor Affinion would give me an interview, but both sent statements. Affinion says it stopped enrolling people without getting written permission. U.S. Bank says the problem was with Affinion.
No, that's the Bart Simpson defense. I wasn't there. I didn't do it. You can't prove anything.
Edmer Zwinski is a consumer advocate at U.S. PIRG. He says fraud in these anti-fraud products is widespread because they're profitable and banks can automatically charge us once we sign up. Zwinski says, don't even sign up for stuff that's free at first.
The free trial offer only lasts for 3 or 5 days. And if you forget to or fail to cancel, they start billing your credit card on a monthly basis.
Bottom line, as depressing as this is, watch out for fraud, even if somebody says they'll help you for free. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
television, how it's changing, how you watch it, when you watch it, and what you are watching. It's our series, Screen Wars.
Television. Got this.
No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
Rotten Tomatoes has been around for about 15 years now. It's the website that pulls together reviews from professional critics and, in so doing, helps you decide whether a movie is fresh, that's good, or rotten, that is bad. Just this past week, though, there was a bit of a sea change. It is giving television reviews equal billing on its front page. Matt Achety is the editor-in-chief at Rotten Tomatoes. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You guys cover television now. You have been for a year.
Yes.
Obviously a smart business move, right? You need more people at the site. I wonder, though, whether it wasn't a little bit cultural, too.
It's absolutely cultural. I mean, TV's where it's at creatively. There's some excellent TV on, and now we can be part of the discussion.
And are you seeing that traffic now? I mean, numbers are up, right?
Yeah, numbers are up. We're seeing a little bit of traffic. You know, it's training the audience. People are kind of out of the habit, I think, of reading a lot of critics' reviews.
Yeah.
And we're only a year into it. You know, we've been doing movies for 15 years. So a lot of learnings to be done, but we're seeing an increase in traffic, and some of that's definitely around TV.
Speaking of training the viewer, for those who are not familiar with Rotten Tomatoes, give us the, I don't even know how you pronounce it, the tomatometer?
The tomato meter.
Tomato meter?
The tomato meter.
I don't know.
The tomato meter is a measure of percentage of positive reviews from professional critics for a given film or TV show. We mark every review up or down, thumbs up, thumbs down. And the tomato meter percentage is not an average. People think it's an average all the time. It's a percentage of positive sentiment.
On the television thing, not only do you guys do full season reviews, but you do individual episode reviews as well.
Where we can support it.
It seems kind of granular, no?
It is granular, but people follow it that way.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, not every show is like that, but certain shows, Game of Thrones, Mad Men is like that. Gotham, we think, will probably be like that.
The Batman one.
Or the pre-Batman one, yeah. I should say. You know, we are somewhat limited by what the critics are writing about, but
right.
We have been encouraging some critics to weigh in on the shows that we know people are really invested in. What's interesting to me, the difference between covering movies and TV, covering movies from an editorial aspect, especially on the web, is really about the event of the movie opening.
Right.
You know, it's a lot of trailers and clips and talks about, you know, set visits and stories and everything to get people excited about that opening weekend. TV's different, though. TV, people have really emotional relationships with the characters. And you hear people talk about, oh, God, did you see what happened with Walter White and his wife last night?
Yeah.
It's gossip. They invite these people into their homes because they're invested in those characters' lives.
So talk to me then about this thing that happens now where Netflix and Amazon Prime are releasing it all at once. And it becomes, in effect, as you watch 13 episodes of House of Cards or what have you, it becomes like a 13-hour movie, not an episodic TV thing.
Yeah, it's a really weird gray area. I mean, you could see The Nick is like that. Even though The Nick on Cinemax is being parsed out one episode at a time— they shot that like a movie. Like that was a 70-day shoot. So, you know, it's what happens with Transparent,
which
I should
Amazon
mention,
Prime,
100% on the
title. I saw that.
Right
I was
now.
Looking, yeah.
Yeah, people are going crazy over that. There's already talk about getting a Golden Globe for Jeffrey Tambor.
How do you feel about movie and TV studio public relations efforts as a way to counter what it is that you guys do?
You know, they love us when we like them, and they hate us when we don't.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, do I see commercials where people are quoting Twitter comments as if they're review pull quotes and very, very tiny letters on the screen? It'll have a Twitter username. I think that the studio publicists and the network publicists, any good news sells. And if they can't go to critics, if they can't go to the experts, they'll go to the fans. That's fine. I don't think that's going to do away with critical thought.
Matt Achety is the editor-in-chief at Rotten Tomatoes. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Our series, Screen Wars, is up on our website. You can also hear all the folks we've talked to weigh in on what they think TV might look like in about 25 years or so. It's all online, as I said, at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that it is pumpkin spice latte time at a certain coffee shop a lot of us go to. What, you ask, does that have to do with anything? Well, it's got this. The good people, clearly good people with too much time on their hands at the Washington Post, have run the numbers and figured out when peak decorative gourd season is. You know, pumpkins, squash, and the like that show up carved and on people's porches and mantles this time of year. Anyway, here you go. Based on an analysis of Google searches, decorative gourd season apparently runs from late August to early November. The third Thursday in October, you heard it here first, folks, is peak decorative gourd day. Also, pumpkin spice latte is not coffee. That's my editorial comment for the day. All right, we're done on a Friday. The Dow up 1%, 167 points. The NASDAQ also up 1%. That is 45 points. The S&P 500 advanced 0.8%, 16 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday. Have a good weekend, everybody. It's not coffee. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.